the move toward cash transfer as a part of humanitarian response is here to stay. And the question is, how can we create the ability to provide those cash transfers in fragile environments as quickly as possible?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Civil war broke out in Sudan in April 2023. And by now, according to the IRC, more than half of the population requires some kind of humanitarian aid. Almost 15 million people have been displaced. The war has also devastated the digital communications infrastructure in Sudan, and that's deepening the crisis. African Renaissance Partners is a VC firm that backs entrepreneurs who use technology to solve major development challenges. Magdi Amin is a managing partner. He also has 2 decades of experience with the World Bank and the IFC, and he's currently attempting to help build and restore Sudan's digital infrastructure to help that humanitarian response. So how is he approaching the task, and what does this tell us about the need for this type of infrastructure in fragile states? Magdi, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. Much appreciated, and thanks for focusing on Sudan.
First of all, Magdi, tell me, what is this conflict in Sudan? What's it about? How did it start?
The conflict in Sudan has deep roots. I would go back to the rule of Omar al-Bashir, ruled for 29 years, and like a lot of fragile, insecure regimes, spent a lot of the country's resources on security. He had the army. He came from the army. It was a military coup that overthrew a democratically elected government in 1989. But he did not trust the military and couldn't use it to fight some of the battles they were fighting. So they first built up the intelligence services. And then when the Darfur conflict came, he armed the then Janjaweed to fight its battle in Darfur with populations that had some ethnic differences and also livelihood differences. So that became, over time, the rapid support forces. He allowed them to keep the resources that they had gained, and particularly gold resources. He also gave them some legal recognition. When the Popular Revolution overthrew al-Bashir and also disbanded the security services, there was on the military side, the army, SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces, and the Rapid Support Forces on the one side, and then they formed a partnership, a government, after months and months of protests and a massacre in Khartoum. They formed a partnership agreement with the civilian forces, who were then aligned to govern for 3 years and then extend it to a 4-year transition period where then would lead to elections. I joined that as an advisor to the Minister of Finance, where we were trying to build out a cash transfer program, many other things, but really is focused on the economic reforms required to recover from al-Bashir. That partnership worked for a while, but then it started to fray. And to make a long story short, the military took over, took full power, arrested the prime minister, Abdalla Hamdok. And for a while after that period, there were attempts to try to restart the transition, to get the military to come to its senses, because there were so many reforms, so many openings, reintegration in the international financial community. We had a roughly 950 million that would have been arriving in Sudan to support the economy within weeks had that coup not happened. It was in October 2021. By April 2023, the coup had not been reversed, and the two military leaders, the tensions between them for actually ruling the country and taking control of the resources, they basically went to war. The plan was to integrate the two, that the rapid support forces, they were asking for a long integration period of 8 to 10 years. The army wanted them to integrate within 2 years. So that on the face of it was the last remaining disagreement. But underneath there, there were just real tensions and competition for supremacy. The rapid support forces had troops in and around inside of Khartoum and around many, many big cities. And so when the fighting took place, they took over civilian areas and created the large-scale displacement. And there's been a lot of atrocities throughout the country, Darfur, Khartoum, Al Jazeera. And for months, they were winning battle after battle, and their troops, when they take over territory, they take over the civilian infrastructure, they sort of terrorize the civilians. Not to say that the SAF has not done equally horrendous things, and they have, but in terms of pure displacement and why there's such a big refugee population, it's a result of the tactics that the RSF used when it was essentially mercenary, and they're living off of the resources that they take over.
Is the whole of the country affected at this point?
Yeah, I would say the whole of the country is affected. There are places that are not in the firing line, parts of the Eastern Sudan and the Northern Sudan, but even them, the entire economy has been affected. And frequent shutdowns of power and banking, the entire banking system, because Khartoum and the country is very centralized in terms of much of the developed infrastructure. And when essentially RSF took over Khartoum, they shut down the financial sector, shut down, and for a long time, the telecom sector. Some of that has been rebuilt and is up and running in some cases, but that affected everybody. A lot of the food production and distribution was in Khartoum, a lot of the factories. So it was a massive loss of infrastructure and economic resources and lives. But beyond that, there's been a lot of stoppages and blockages of humanitarian access by SAF, and in some cases by RSF, because both sides are in some ways using food and food access as a weapon. It's affected pretty much everybody because the farming season also depends on proper access to finance and resources and just the ability to farm. And so then food supplies that are domestically grown were reduced. The storage infrastructure for wheat imports and others were also affected. So yeah, it's been very difficult on the Sudanese people.
I must admit, I was unaware of the scale of the destruction and the crisis stemming from this conflict. And there has been surprisingly little coverage in the international media. Why so little?
It's the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, but it happened at the same time as there's an active conflict in Gaza and an active conflict in Ukraine. And maybe there's a bit of fatigue. Maybe there's other factors involved where something so large and so difficult wasn't getting the attention and focus. I would say the U.S. was very much focused on the Middle East and Ukraine, and a lot of the resources were also going there. It's Africa, and sometimes I guess people see this sort of a chronic long-term problem as opposed to something that needs to be solved now, but really just a diversion of focus to other very difficult problems, but just without the scale of the Sudan problem.
So we're focusing today on the digital infrastructure in Sudan. How has that been affected by the conflict?
As a part of the problem in the banking sector, when so many resources were affected and banks were shut down, there were a few players that were able to move money before the conflict. A couple of the banks had reasonable investments in being able to move money. A couple of the fintechs, particularly MTN, had a pretty effective process. And there were some fintechs that were also rising to be able to provide financial services and payments in particular. When the conflict broke out, a lot of them weren't able to operate initially. And then over time, only one really started to be able to move money in and out. And it became overwhelmingly the largest choice that families who are trying to provide resources, move money to remittances to people who are affected by the conflict in Sudan. Mm-hmm. We're using one app or one company, which is the Bank of Khartoum, and their app called Bankak, means your bank. But there's a lot of dependency on one. It's very fragile. It doesn't cover everybody. Not everybody has an account. So people are using one person's account to serve multiple family members. So it's a very fragile situation. And sometimes Bankak itself was not operating. And their switch is overseas, is in the UAE. So there's some fragility there as well for the Sudan. And it's costly. A few other players have tried to come in, but it's just both the cost and access when so many people, large scale, need access to be able to receive help from overseas, even to move money within the country. It compounds the problem that's already existing because of food insecurity.
Why is there so little access, available infrastructure at the moment? Who or what is causing this?
Well, it wasn't great before. I have to say that there was a national switch. There was a focus on interoperability within banks. But Sudan had a long period of underinvestment, in part because of sanctions. So they could not make the necessarily technology investments. Basically, they were sanctioned. And so their outdated technology was being used. The national switch also had a bad governance model. It was originally designed to support the banks. But over time, mobile money and the telcos became a bigger force in this. And Sudan's government had one telco that was part of the governance of the switch. So there was a conflict of interest between them and the other telcos. A lot of banks and telcos were slow to make the necessary investments to catch up with the rest of the world on mobile money. It's not Kenya or Tanzania or Nigeria or elsewhere where you have a lot of either telco-driven, fintech-driven, or bank-driven investment and development. One of the big telcos was using it primarily to move minutes, and minutes was serving as a form of currency outside of the legal process. The government was moving forward with its regulatory regime, but it was not moving very quickly. So this is a combination of factors meant that as a sector needed a lot of investment. When we did the cash transfer program, there were all kinds of obstacles that we had to confront and work through, including the regulation, including the state of infrastructure. And we would try to move payments, and we'd find that one telco in particular just had a huge backlog because they hadn't made the necessary investments. MTN was doing well. Bank of Khartoum was doing relatively well in this space, but the vast majority of others, look, over almost 30 banks, the vast majority of them weren't very helpful and effective as outlets for moving for mobile money.
So how does this affect the day-to-day lives of Sudanese people if they don't have this access? Also, how does this affect the functioning of that cash transfer program?
The cash transfer program ended with the coup. Immediately, all international support, and that had a number of Sudan's development partners providing funding. But that ended. The World Bank support ended. Primarily European and U.S. government were funding it. All of that support ended. There was a small program that got restarted a little bit later with the World Food Program and other support, but the large program that we were doing came to a halt. Until then, we were having some difficulty with, first of all, registration, the civil registry, which you're using to verify identities. A lot of people hadn't updated their data, and a lot of people were not registered. So there were challenges there. But the primary challenges were getting people to be able to register on their phone and to receive payments on their phone. The infrastructure investments just hadn't been made. And so there were challenges. But that said, it did spread. Millions of people were starting to get those payments. And then the coup happened, and it just ended everything. As of today, we have that fragility of having one major provider, and yet a lot of people who can't rely on that one provider, a whole country that should hopefully the civil war end soon, will need assistance for a long time to get back on their feet, and they'll need all infrastructure and other investments. The food sector, agriculture will need to be revived. But this channel will certainly be part of the solution. So how can we go from the fragility and dependence today to something much more open and much more interoperable? And that's what we're thinking about with different players. And we're excited about the possibility of more of a digital public infrastructure approach.
For now, I guess, with so much of the population needing some kind of humanitarian support, then this lack of infrastructure, that must be a major barrier to that.
It is a major barrier. If you can't reach people in a timely basis without a lot of extra costs and middlemen involved, a lot of the resources will be consumed by this friction that a lack of infrastructure creates. If you have to rely on banks, bank branches were not very widespread outside of the capital. So you could rely on some NGOs, but then the issue with the using a lot of different NGO options is that it's very hard to scale something up that can be sustainable at a national level when you're using a lot of different NGO providers in different parts with different standards and different technologies.
The two sides in this conflict, they must benefit as well if the digital infrastructure was restored or improved. The people that they hope would support them would benefit if that was improved. Don't they have an incentive to support any work to help restore service?
The question of how do you make sure that people on the ground can be helped and saved is a little bit different. If we rely on either purely government channels or the official channels that any of those two parties might favor, then you could imagine that part of the transaction volume or part of the benefits or whatever other aspects might require investment, that they would benefit from those processes. As far as who gets funding on the ground that they can use to purchase food in the market, that's going to depend on the individual either using their identification or their mobile phones for identification, some way to verify uniquely who is getting the funds. And it's better, and I think in our view, and a lot of other development partners have reached the same view, that it's better to get it to the individual directly on their phone rather than to use intermediaries that then would take some of those funds or make the resources conditional on, you know, their political views or who they are.
So Magda, tell me about the work that you are doing to help build and restore this infrastructure. What is the project?
We're looking at how can digital public infrastructure come in a very resource-constrained, difficult environment and make better use of the infrastructure that does exist, but remove the barriers to coming online and being able to provide financial services. Mm-hmm. So there's a project or a program called Moja Loop, which is now being deployed in Rwanda. A version of it was deployed in Tanzania. It's also being deployed in South Sudan and a few other areas. What Moja Loop does is essentially unify and streamline the process for any financial service provider, whether it be a bank or a telco or a fintech or others, to connect into a integrated, interoperable, seamless system. In India, there's something called the Unified Payments Interface, UPI. So UPI mm-hmm. became an essentially public rails on which financial services providers can connect and be enabled to provide efficiently financial services. Individuals then use their own ID to be able to then transact. Other countries like Brazil and others have their own versions of this public infrastructure. And by public, we mean open source, ideally open standards. And what we think Moja Loop can do is help reduce the dependence and streamline the process of new providers, whether they be banks, telcos, or fintechs, to come in and connect into that one network in Sudan that would be able to move money. So we reduce the friction, reduce the processes. Otherwise, just to make the counter example, anybody who wants to provide financial services would need to agree on the protocols, would need to develop their own commercial agreements, would need to come up with agreements with any other node that they need to connect to provide financial services. So a telco to a bank, a telco to a international service provider. All of that individual process then creates a very slow expansion of financial services and high level of friction, which Sudan can't really afford right now. And so by unifying this, by creating essentially a unified standard for this to be created across the country, essentially public rails, an instant payment system, then I think the process of eventually getting many more people with the ability to access those services quickly in a timely basis with low costs, we can then realize that vision.
So in a situation where institutions are weak and capacity is constrained, how do you go about this to encourage people to take that action, to be involved?
It's true that one of the issues around digital public infrastructure and where it's been successful, you have fairly strong governments. Even within in Africa, the ones that have rolled it out well have had pretty good, effective civil service. And India, Brazil, and other countries around the world that are characterized by this. Now, we can build on all of the experience that we've had in Sudan's teams that have governed the financial services in the past are still there. The central bank team, for example, that looked at mobile money before and set out the regulations are working, and they're able to understand and they've looked at these models. And so this is not entirely new to them. They would need to provide the governance overview for such a system. But then once the agreements are there and the overall regulatory framework is set, the technology is now tested. It's not a difficult prospect. And so for new players to come in and to use a much simpler way of connecting, it actually will reduce the regulatory or let's say the capacity burden on the country as opposed to raise it. So it actually is a better solution for a fragile environment if the state at least can provide the regulatory oversight.
Who has the power to make this happen, to make this stick?
The question of who has the power in Sudan is up for grabs right now.
Yeah.
Certainly there is a government. The central bank is the central bank. It's just that there are rebel-held territories that are not really governed.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully, you know, maybe, who knows, with this new administration taking a slightly different approach and really lining up the external stakeholders that are fueling the conflict and helping them realize that Sudan's descent into a failed state is in nobody's interest. The level of conflict that is there now can spread to other countries in the region, and it's in everybody's interest to halt that spread and get Sudan back into, and I think everybody agrees among the stakeholders, to a civilian government. That situation needed a different approach, a different strategy, assuming that that strategy does take hold, and I know that's a big ask. Immediately, we're going to confront this very large scale need to help people rebuild their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody, whether they're in rebel held territory or whether they're in the government held territory, which is recently increasing, would need to have this kind of infrastructure. And I think the agreement led by the central bank to get this implemented across Sudan will play a key part. But I'm not going to underplay the significance of getting the conflict resolved. That is really need to get people to stop shooting and stop taking territory and letting people rebuild their lives, because the neglect is also creating many more lives lost and destroyed simply for a lack of focus on humanitarian support.
Yes, the problems in Sudan are particularly acute, but other regions have or may soon have similar challenges. What does this crisis teach policymakers about the importance of developing and restoring these kind of digital services?
I think we've all learned over time, providers of humanitarian help have learned that it is very difficult to move food and other resources into regions, and that it can be counterproductive over time to the population's ability to recover, and that they move from that to providing money and then finally moving cash transfers digitally that they can use to purchase locally and then help eventually rebuild markets over time. And that people are in the best position to choose whether they need food or shelter or blankets or whatever other resources they need to rebuild their lives. So I think the move toward cash transfer as a part of humanitarian response is here to stay. And the question is, how can we create the ability to provide those cash transfers in fragile environments as quickly as possible? Digital public infrastructure is an important part of the response. As more and more of those tools get tested and deployed around the world, we're finding that the use case of fragile states and whether DPI, digital public infrastructure, is relevant in that environment, we're still testing. It's still a work in progress. But there are lots of elements that make it easier for all the service providers to become functional in a state that needs it. And it's no doubt that when you've destroyed a lot of the banks and physical infrastructure, that you need to go digital. Africa has very young populations that are very digitally savvy and ready. Mobile phone penetration is very rapid. It is no secret that mobile money leapfrogged in Africa to traditional banking much faster than other regions. And the same will be true, you know, those building on those forces, young, digitally connected, mobily connected populations is the best way to then also provide that humanitarian response, just like other more developed or more stable environments.
Can I ask you, Magdi, how optimistic or fearful are you about the consequences of either succeeding in building this digital infrastructure or if it cannot be rebuilt in a reasonable time?
And it's not only the violence and lives lost, but the ability for Sudan as a very diverse population with different cultures and traditions and ideologies to live together, to come back to a place where there's sort of tolerance and respect. That to me is my larger fear. I would say the technological solutions to allow people a little bit of a lifeline. Other Sudanese are the biggest providers of help to Sudanese right now, and they just have a hard time using very few channels. And it's a very fragile situation. In addition, fragile, not only the conflict sense, but in the vulnerability sense of having that sort of sole reliance. So helping reduce that kind of fragility, going to a much more ability for many, many providers to come into a system easily helps address that. My fear is, don't do this. More people will suffer the consequences of not being able to buy food or access food or other resources in markets. They'll become more vulnerable. More young people would then be attracted to join these forces who are just taking other people's resources as mercenaries. We don't want that. We don't want the incentives to be toward continued conflict. Yeah. Everybody who can help at every level is going to be needed going forward, and we just haven't had that focus, unfortunately, so far.
Magdi, we appreciate the work that you're doing and also for taking the time to talk to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated, Tim. Anybody who's focusing on Sudan is a friend.
This has been a Vox Dev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our episodes are at voxdev.org, and if you like what you hear, please tell someone else about it.